Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week at the station of KHOI Community Radio, beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. Welcome to our kitchen table. We get by with a lot of help from lots of people, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, the Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Thank you, Practical Farmers, and thank you, our listeners, for joining us today. You can hear this radio show and lots of other good radio shows on this station. Go to khoyfm.org. You can stream, you can download things, you can go to the webpage there and find out all of the good stuff that's happening on this radio station. This is community radio. We are volunteers. We are people that are on the radio because we want to be, and we talk about what we want to talk about. That's kind of, I think, how radio should work, and that's how this radio station works. And while you're on that webpage, there is a magic button there called the donate button. We get by with your support. So thank you. We had a great weekend, a busy weekend,
oh,
Donna.
Oh, boy, I'm still recovering.
It was. This was the annual Practical Farmers of Iowa Conference, and the conference gets bigger and bigger every year.
I don't think they've released numbers, but 600 or 700 probably farmers from all over Iowa.
At least. And
it was fun. It was informative. It was delicious.
It was delicious. The delicious part is always really good. We're going to share with you today a bit from the keynote speaker that came all the way from England to speak at this conference. And you think, what would somebody in England have to say to a bunch of people?
Well, he's a farmer.
So there was this farmer that came, and he's a very famous farmer. He's not only a farmer, he's a writer. His name is James Rebanks. He kind of made a big splash here a while ago by writing a book called The Shepherd's Life. And that book kind of made an unexpected bit of noise on the book scene because everybody all of a sudden wanted to know about his sheep farm. He's a shepherd.
Yes, this is from the book. James Rebanks runs a family-owned farm in the Lake District in northern England. His first book, The Shepherd's Life, was a New York Times bestseller, and named a top 10 book of the year. His popular Twitter feed is at herdy.shepherd1. That's in case you want to do that. He'd probably be interesting to follow. So it's a little at sign, H-E-R-D-Y Shepherd number one, to share updates on his shepherding year.
Yes, he's actually quite popular on the tweetosphere. Everybody kind of likes to follow what's going on this small farm in the Lake District of England. The Lake District is kind of on the left-hand side of England, kind of North, butted up against Scotland up there. It's very hilly. It's very rough. And as James told us, not much good for much except sheep.
And tourists. It's very well known as where the romantic poets hung out, like Wordsworth. And so they get a lot of people who go there for the scenery and the atmosphere.
And it's full of that, too. So we're going to listen to a little bit of what James Rebanks has to tell us. He gives us thoughts on farming, a history of the Lake District. It has a very long, long history.
And the kind of farming that he does has been going on for at least 400 years.
Right. Yeah, he's got a long history there. He grows a sort of sheep called Herdwick sheep, very old, hardy bunch of sheep. And he also talks a bit about Beatrix Potter. Beatrix Potter was one of his neighbors up there, and there's a little bit about that at the end of this segment. So let's hear what James Rebanks has to say.
When I was about 13, I used to follow my grandfather around the farm. Okay, there's an old farmer called Huey Rebanks. But one of the things my grandfather told me was never tell anybody else how to farm. Okay? He said, you don't know the land better than they do. You don't know their troubles better than they do. They may know more than you about a whole bunch of things. Never tell them. So when I read the program for this conference, and it said I was going to give you a vision of how you could restore agriculture in Iowa, I was in a panic. Because no way am I going to come and tell you how to farm your land in Iowa. You're the experts. But maybe I can tell you a little bit about my life and some of the things we've done and some of the challenges we have, and maybe that will be useful for you. From the hill behind my house, you look to Scotland. You can see Scotland in the distance. Conventionally, in English history and English thinking, this is the far end of nowhere, okay? But they've got that absolutely the wrong way around. It's the best bit of England by a country mile. And it's a really tough, plain, hard, marginal, choose-your-own-word landscape to farm in. I spent the afternoon going round today with Renee and Kevin and Joe in the car, amazed at how flat Iowa is, or this bit of Iowa. And amazed at how much soil you have. I'm tempted to say still have, because I know there are issues. But I think you have more soil in one of your big Iowa fields than we have in the whole of our 13 valleys of the Lake District. So it's a tough place, and it requires a particular kind of farming. The first thing to say about our way of farming is that it isn't the coldest place in Europe, it isn't the coldest place in the world, it isn't the coldest place where people farm. You farm in much colder conditions in winter than we do. So minus 17 is like the lowest temperature we've had in the last few years. The toughness of our landscape is the combination of cold and wet and windy for very long periods of time. And any of you that farm livestock will know that cold and wet and windy is often worse than dry and cold. In fact, it's probably the hardest place where sheep live outside all year round in the world. If you go any further north than us, sheep tend to live in colder, drier places than they live inside in the winter. So this is, my sheep have to go through some pretty extreme stuff. But I'm jumping ahead of myself here. When I was 14 years old, and I was at school, I hated school. I thought school was nothing to do with me. And I thought school had nothing to do with me. Why did they want me to teach me Esperanto or Latin or... Why were they talking about Shakespeare? I wanted to talk about sheep. I wanted to talk about cattle. And I didn't think that... I thought school was all about taking me somewhere else, making me into somebody else. And I didn't want to be that someone else. I wanted to be my father and my grandfather. And there's an episode that I describe in my book which sums this up. I, along with every other kid in my school, had to go and see the careers advisor. You have careers advisors? Yeah. This was in the late 1980s. He'd just got a new computer, one of those sort of large, clunky computers from the late 1980s, and he'd just got a piece of software which would take your preferences and tell you what job you should do. Yeah. So his first question was, do you want to work inside or outside? And I said, outside. And one of his other questions was, do you want to work with animals? I said, yes. And it went on like this for about 10 minutes, and then triumphantly, he pressed the return button on his piece of software. It thought for a little while, it shook a little bit, made a noise, and then it printed a piece of paper out, and on the paper was two words, only two words. It said I should be a zookeeper. And we lived in probably one of the finest stock-rearing areas in England, where almost everybody was from a farming family. And I remember thinking, how weird is this world that it has no interest in what I want, no interest in where I'm from, no interest in my culture. With hindsight, I should have been a grown-up 14 and 15-year-old. I should have said, do you know what? I'm going to ignore some of their prejudices, and I'm going to learn as much as I can, and I'm going to learn all the things I need to do to be a good farmer. I wasn't a grown-up 14 and 15-year-old, so I didn't do that. I did the other thing where you misbehave, and you drag your feet to school, and you chat back to the teacher, and you refuse to do what you're told, and you don't do your homework, and you leave on the first possible day that they let you out. And that's what I did. The irony being that I'd only been left school about 6 months when I realized that being on the farm in the middle of nowhere was quite boring at night. I don't mean through the day. I love farming. So that, what do you do? Well, what I did, I started picking books up out of my mother's bookcase that she'd inherited from her grandfather, and I fell in love with books. And I fell in love with one book in particular called A Shepherd's Life by a writer called W.H. Hudson. And what W.H. Hudson did was he rode out into the English countryside in the 1890s and the early 1900s, and he met this shepherd called Caleb Bowcombe in Wiltshire. And he sat and listened to this guy talk about his life story, and he put it down in the book. This was a light bulb moment for me. After flunking 5 or 6 years of secondary school or high school, I think you call it, I suddenly realized that books were useful and exciting and could be about people like us. And I'd somehow managed to not have that moment all the way through. So I started reading, and it set off a whole sort of double life that I've had ever since. I'll get back to the farm a little bit. So I'm slightly envious of you guys. I don't know whether to be envious or pity you. It's difficult, isn't it? Because you've got a very modern, very, very efficient landscape. I know you're dealing with the problems of that, and whether it's gone too far, and whether it needs to be more mixed, etc., etc. But you have quite a lot of freedom, relatively, in terms of what you can do on your land. There's all sorts of opportunities open to you. We don't have that. We don't have it for two reasons. One, because there's almost nothing else you can do on our land except for what we do. And two, we don't want to do anything else, because we're from a 10,000-year-old farming culture. So the whole landscape, the field structure, the roads, the houses, the buildings, everything is as a result of this 10,000 years of history. And if they ever do awards for the most efficient business-like farming landscape on earth, they won't come anywhere near me and my neighbours. But if they are interested in historic and relatively sustainable old-fashioned farming landscapes, then ours is much more interesting. So we've come from we live in very different landscapes with very different pros and cons. And one of the obsessions that everybody in my landscape has is to breed the best of these sheep. Yeah. Now, if we were just businessmen, it should be, can we make the most money out of these sheep? But if I'm being honest, that's not really the obsession. The obsession is to be the top shepherd breeding the best sheep, because that was always the goal that they had in that landscape. One of the amazing things about Britain as a historic farming landscape is that if you travel about 20 or 30 miles, you hit another area where there was another historic breed of cattle or sheep or pigs or poultry. And there's an amazing agricultural diversity there. But they all have very particular strengths. And really their strength is through selective evolution, selective breeding, over very long periods of time to survive in our landscape. So the Herdwick sheep, those sheep can survive 6 months of cold, wet rain on a mountain in a way that no other sheep I've ever experienced in my life can. They're really smart on a mountain in the way that most sheep aren't. Most people are used to thinking sheep are stupid. These sheep are really mountain savvy. They know when the weather's coming. They'll go to the right side of the mountain. They know where the best place to be is at different times. They even have a bizarre trait, which is more or less a cultural trait, which is that they stay in their own place on the mountain, even though it isn't enclosed and fenced around them. Why do they do that? Because they've been going there in an unbroken genetic chain, with daughter following mother, for, we think, 1,000 years, and possibly 4,500, 5,000 years since the first sheep, which is absolutely remarkable, which means that in the spring when I take my sheep back to the mountain, definitively, I'm quite possibly doing something that somebody like me did every spring, which is completely bonkers, isn't it? And yes, it has constraints, and yes, it's difficult for me to be really modern and really efficient, but I happen to love it. I happen to think if something can last 5,000 years, that must be relatively sustainable. What I was trying to tell you was, these sheep have like a double fleece. They have like a waistcoat underneath, which is very fine haired, and then they have an outer layer of grey, hard wool on the outside that the rain runs off. They're hardly ever wet at the bottom of their fleece. They are perfectly adapted to do something really clever, which is to survive with the minimum of food on a mountain through winter. And then, round about the 1st of April, when the grass suddenly comes in the mountain, to drop a lamb, preferably one lamb, not two or three, because on a mountain you want one lamb and to go and look after it, and to then milk that lamb to be as big and as good as possible by October when the grass disappears. And the system was simple. Your sheep came down to the valley bottom to lamb, and then they went back up to the mountain on the 1st of April, 2nd of April, whatever, when the grass arrived, with their lamb, and they came off in October, and they produced you your replacements for your flock and a cash crop that you sold, or the surplus male lambs that you ate. And that is basically how people lived in my landscape for those 5 or 10,000 years. And again, that's remarkable. One of the things I've learned on my farm in the last 10 years in particular is that people knew what they were doing in the past. Okay. Now, the story of my farm and the story I tell in my book is that my grandfather wasn't actually the same kind of farmer as me. My grandfather was a 1950 modernizing progressive farmer. Okay. Why keep these old heritage breeds? You can keep a more modern lowland breed, and you can buy really cheap food, grain from the American Midwest or somewhere else coming in. You can keep them alive. There's plenty of oil. Put them in a shed. Heat the shed. Put the lights on. And then about 10, 15 years ago, the costs started to kill our kind of farming. So the global commodity prices keep the costs of what we sell down, and the price of everything's rocketing. What's the solution? Well, it comes back to some of the things I've heard earlier, which is my father and I decided that maybe people knew what they were doing in the past. Let's go back to the breeds that they used to have that require no supplementary feeding or little, no housing, can survive in the climate that we have and can produce something from almost nothing. So my farming system is all about producing as much as I possibly can, of as high a value as I can, from as little as possible. The big thing that I've learned in my farming, I've learned two big things in my farming life, which is that you're sort of never right and you're never finished learning, are you? Anybody here going to put their hand up and say that they've learned everything they need to know about farming? No, me neither. I'm a long way from knowing everything. Every day is a school day. I'm always learning. So I'm learning about soil, a whole bunch of stuff I wish I'd known 20 years ago about soil. I'm suddenly learning. I'm learning about ecosystems and all the rest of it. I also think I'm learning about economics. So a few years ago, I was asked by a friend to do a business plan for my farm. Do you know what the first line was? I decided if I was going to do a business plan, it was going to be an honest business plan. Do you know what the first line was? I want to keep hold of the farm. Yeah, that's not strictly speaking a business plan objective, but it's my number one thing. We've had our farm or neighboring farms for 600 years, as far back as the paperwork goes. So 600 years ago, in 1420, my family were only about 4 miles over the hill, which means we're the exact opposite of all you adventurous people who set out, got in boats, and came to America and did all sorts of exciting things. We're the people that never went anywhere. And I reckon if it's been okay for 600 years, I'm just going to stick with it. So I'm sticking, and I want to try and respect the stuff I care about, but I want to give it a future. I've got 4 kids. By the way, don't have 4 kids. I'm destroyed. But that's a side note. So the point is, a farm is somewhere where you live, isn't it? It isn't just a business. It's somewhere where you live. It's often somewhere where you have roots. It's somewhere where your parents and your grandparents worked. It's somewhere that reflects your values. It's a thing of beauty. It's part of a water system. It's part of an ecosystem. It's part of a place that birds and insects migrate over. It's loads of things other than a business. And I think when we talk about farming, we tend to use the language of economics. There's the language of factories. And I feel like it's a pretty flawed language because it doesn't talk about a lot of the things that matter. So most of what we've been told by economists is that cheap is good. But you all know cheap is not always good. That is not as simple as that. Cheap usually means monoculture. Cheap usually means as industrial as possible. Cheap often means degradation of the things that we care about. So I think we need to be really, really careful about the economic language and to think perhaps more, less about efficiency and more about balance and sustainability and biodiversity. This is my creed in a nutshell. This is But the point was a simple one. When I set out to write the book, and the grown-up version of the book, and I wanted to, if I could, tell people, particularly people in cities, why rural people aren't stupid, why they're not ignorant, why they're not backwards. I wanted to present the pride and the hard work and the dignity and the smartness. And yes, the cussedness sometimes of the country people. And that's what I try my absolute best to do. And one of the things I've loved is how much respect I've encountered through that, not for me, but for you. So people, 2 years ago I had to go to do an event like this in a theatre in New York, in the middle of Manhattan. And I'm thinking, who the hell in Manhattan is going to come and listen to me talk about this stuff? There was more people there than there were here. It was because people really care about food. They've become very disconnected from it. They're distrustful of what's going on. They don't quite know how to make the decisions they need to make. But they care about what you do, and I think they're going to care more and more as they get wealthier, as they get more free time, etc., to try and have a conversation with the public about what they want, and to make it an honest conversation. So if people want mixed rotational farming with livestock in the mix, that's potentially less efficient. That's potentially more expensive. You've got to pay more. So we need to start having real conversations about what that means, tough conversations about it. That's a picture of Beatrix Potter, that lady behind the sheep. Okay? Really quick story I'll tell you. You can read it in my book, but I can't resist telling you. Beatrix Potter buys these little farms in the Lake District. She decides that she cares about the sheep that we have there, the native breed that have been there a very long time, the Herdwicks. She decides she'd like to breed really good ones. Okay? So she hires this shepherd. He's called Tom Story. So Beatrix Potter goes down to the sheep pens, and she goes through all of the sheep, and she chooses the ones that she wants to take to the show to compete with the other shepherds. And then she comes back up to the house and she says to this guy, who's much younger than her, much poorer than her, and working for her, yeah? And she's a sort of wealthy lady. She says, I've chosen the show sheep. And Tom Story says, that isn't happening. And she looks at him sort of slightly strangely. He said, I'm the shepherd, and the shepherd chooses which sheep go to the show. And if you don't like that, you can get another shepherd. And I think she didn't know what to do with this. She's supposed to be the boss, yeah? She's probably wondering, is he a sexist little pig? And she's probably, you know, all sorts of things going on there. But she actually calmed down. She went to the house, said to his wife that he was a bad-tempered sod, and then she went off, she calmed down, and she actually thought about it. And what she understood, which very few people do when they think about those kind of landscapes or skills, is that actually he had all the knowledge. If they wanted to do the thing properly, she needed him. She needed to respect this guy and his knowledge and his culture. And she decided to work with him instead. And they formed this unlikely partnership where they actually ended up breeding great sheep. And that was the highlight of their showing career. That sheep is called Water Lily. And it won the biggest show that you can win in the Lake District. There's a championship show at Eshtal. And they won that day. And I love that picture because she's the boss with all the money who bought the farm. And he's holding the sheep. And I look at that photograph and I think, neither of them is quite sure who the boss is.
Been listening to a few words about what it's like to be a shepherd in the Lake Country of England from James Rebanks. James Rebanks is on his family farm. He's been there a long time. The farm is largely permanent pasture and hay meadows, and he specializes in raising high-value breeding stock, native Herdwick Swaledale sheep, and he also talked about a British cattle breed called the Blue Greys when he was here this weekend for the Practical Farmers of Iowa Conference. We'll hear more from James Rebanks later. You are listening to KHOI 89.1, this is Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Thank you. was a tune called Newcastle. Newcastle is a city on the northeastern shore of England, and our thoughts today are on the northwestern shore of England because we're talking about a book called The Shepherd's Life and its author, James Rebanks, and we're talking about him because we got to encounter him and lots of other really interesting farmers at the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference this past weekend. We learned a lot of new things, and we ate. Get some farmers together, and we ate. Donna, talk about the food.
Well, it's a multi-day conference, so there's lots of meals. And the effort was made. Some of it was prepared by the ISU culinary team, and some of it Lana and I made, along with Story City Locker. So the dinner that Lana and I did was the Friday night potluck, and so the Gustafsons from Story City Locker had a couple of whole pigs from Crooked Gap Farm in Knoxville, and they were really good. The breed was something called an Iowa Hereford. It's like apparently, I think, black and white. I'm not sure, or spotted or something. But the point is the breed was actually, as Mr. Rebanks talks about, that breed of pig was actually bred in Iowa for this climate here. And it was good. And they, I think we had one whole pig complete with the apple in its mouth and the head and the feet and everything, and we carved off of that. And then we also had some more pulled pork, and I think he cooked the pig in his smoker, in his probably his basement bacon smoker up at Story City Locker. And then I cooked up a big batch of Iowa-grown kidney beans, and they were so fresh. You know how sometimes you can soak the beans overnight, and you can cook them and cook them and cook them, and they just take forever. These, I only soaked them like 45 minutes, and then I cooked them less than an hour, and they were creamy. Really, really good.
They were good. And it was a lot of beans. There was this huge industrial cooker that you cooked them in. It was quite daunting for someone like me, but Donna just dived
right in. 25 pounds of beans. That's a lot of kidney beans. And when I got them from the farmer, I can tell you, they were pretty much out of the field. I had to pick through all of those. My little fingers touched every single bean. We had to get out the stones and the pieces of grass, and it had some black beans mixed in it. And I think I spent a week every night. I'd take a couple of trays and spread them out on the cookie sheet and pick through. And I just kept going. We got it done. It was very good. And then the ISU meals featured a lot of things like Saturday morning breakfast was a polenta bar with Remnant Hills breakfast sausage and black walnuts from Madsen's Farm, honey cream from Hanson's Dairy, butter from Hanson's Dairy, maple syrup from Turkey River Farm, and, of course, the aronia berries, the only fruit that everyone grows in Iowa that I have a hard time with. So there was a big effort to, and quite a bit of, there were brats from Nyman Ranch and prosciutto from Nyman Ranch. Now, most of the Nyman Ranch pork is grown in Iowa. So it was really nice that we really had very local, very seasonal.
And it was very nice to have polenta as a breakfast option. And this is feeding a lot of people. But instead of the usual donuts and coffee, of course it was coffee too, but it was really good. And more
it was Bergie's coffee. At least it's roasted locally.
It's very good, very good. But the polenta breakfast was lovely. I want to go back to the potluck here. Iowa does potlucks pretty well, but this was kind of potlucks on a large scale. I think maybe just judging from the
350 people.
There we go.
Cut the numbers today,
350 people. And I know lots of people got in without getting counted because I was kind of at the front desk there welcoming people. It was a joy to eat with all these people. People bring their best, and there was people brought their favorite ferments, their favorite pickles, and their favorite...
Lots of good desserts.
I happened to be in line with people I didn't know, so you're talking away there, and we get to the pig. And Ty Gustafson's slicing it off there, and the man in front of me says, "Well, who grew this pig?" And a young farmer, the son of a young farmer. I think he was maybe 12, 11 or 12, with seed cap on. He says, my dad grew that pig. And he had the proud option of saying exactly where that pig came from. And that's just what that whole thing is about. It's really, really nice. So people have been doing this for years. And, of course, we always have a lot of new people. And so it's a fine, fine start to a good weekend. And the theme of the conference was revival, and it was. The conference always has lots of speakers, and people are just bumper to bumper talking to each other, and lots of presenters. I went to an interesting workshop. You go to things that you never thought you'd go to. I learned a lot about research. It was a university thing, too. It was called Using Tea Bags to Assess Soil.
Oh, did you go to that
one? I went to that.
And, so do tell.
Now, this is not just a fly-by-night thing. They just happened to find out that they wanted something that would be a long-term test with many spots of testing and on the field. And the purpose was to see how bad soil or good soil or heavily organic matter soil versus non-organic soil, what that does to the composting of how things break down. And they happen to find that using tea, it already is.
Black tea, yeah. Like a Lipton's tea bag, that kind of tea bag.
Yes, okay. It was already the right size. And they used two teas to they figured this all out in their scientific way. They used a Rebush, a red tea, Lipton's, mm-hmm. and they used a green tea, Lipton's.
Oh, okay.
And they were getting all kinds of good things. They that had trouble before finding things that would decompose but yet be able to scoop up again and measure.
So you bury the tea bags?
They bury the tea bags for a whole growing season.
How deep?
Not very. A couple
Six
inches.
6 inches?
Oh, with a little tag hanging out. Huh?
Oh, so you can find it?
And the tea bags happen to be were something that would not decompose all that much. They were some sort of nylon-y something or other. And so,
not the paper tea bags.
Not the paper ones, because you want to be able to see what has come and what has gone. And some of the early tests to find out the decomposition rates were using cotton. That's a good idea. But again, you put cotton in the ground, and in some cases, there would be nothing left. How do you measure it? So before they got into tea bags, they were, believe it or not, burying cotton underwear. And so and they kept referring to it as dirtying your undies sort of testing. That was fun. And that worked, too. I mean, because the cotton was a good base to deal with. But they found
in a whole year, a pair of cotton underwear only partially degrades?
They were testing different kinds of soil. Is it grassland? Is it highly organic matter? Has it followed soybeans? Was it a vegetable field? They were getting different numbers from everything. But one thing about the underwear was really nice, just like the tea bags. There was something to pick up. Some places the underwear totally almost went away, mm-hmm. and other places you'd pick up this waistband, and well, there was a little something there. So there are people out there finding out earth-shattering questions, and so that was one of the
with tea bags and underwear.
And it's not that I wanted to find out about tea bags or underwear, but it's nice to go through the process. People are asking questions, people are measuring these things, and finding out. Guess what?
So what are they looking at? The rates of decomposition in different kinds of soil.
Right. Over long periods of time. So
a year.
Yeah. Or mainly a growing season, like from fall to spring, which was actually, the tea bags worked really well for that, evidently. Good. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Let's hear some more from shepherd and author James Rebanks from the Lake District of England, talking about sheepdogs and talking about what he eats.
Here's a thing that no farmers will tell you. Most farmers are not very good at training sheepdogs. Yeah, I don't know whether many of you have seen many farmers working sheepdogs, but there's quite often a lot of shouting and cussing and dog hiding under the tractor, or wife in tears walking off with beloved dog across the field because husband's just swore at it. Or there's all that stuff going on. And my dad and me were the same as that. And then about 5 years ago, we had a friend who bred brilliant border collie sheepdogs, a guy called Paul Chester. And I could tell he was reluctant to let me have one of his brilliantly bred sheepdogs. And I realized what the problem was. He didn't think we were going to train it properly. So I persuaded Paul that if he gave me one of these very well-bred sheepdogs, I would make a much better effort than we ever had before. So I did what all traditional ancient farmers do. I went on the internet and bought a DVD called How to Train Your Sheepdog by a man called Andy Nicholas, thinking if anybody sees, any of my friends see me watching a beginner's guide to training sheepdogs, they're going to laugh their head off. So I didn't tell anybody. I just watched this thing. So give you an example. He has techniques that I'd never really thought about properly. How do you get the dog to go away, which is go right at the far side of the sheep, or come by, which is go left at the far side of the sheep? That's a pretty difficult thing to teach a young dog, right? He does something really simple. He builds a round, about the size of this, builds a round pen with hurdles. He puts 6 or 7 sheep in, and you stand outside the pen, and you put the young dog outside the pen, okay? And as the sheep run that way, the dog goes running around the far side. And if you weren't there, the dog will go round and round and round like a lunatic, okay? But you are there, so you block the dog as it comes down this way, and you force it to go back that way. And as it goes back that way, you say, come by, okay? And as it comes back the other way, you block it, and you send it back the other way, and you say, away. And the dog I have called Floss, who's the top dog at my house, well, she's getting a little bit old now, I spent about 5 minutes doing this with her in a pen. She was so good. She picked it up so quickly. I took the pen down. She could do it in the field, no problem. Right? Not all dogs are like that. You can spend six weeks on this pen thing. But something in my brain was like, this dog's smarter than I am. So I took the pen down. She's brilliant. I never put her in the pen again. But it's just an example. Somebody smart has a way of doing something that you don't have. Just copy them. Don't be too proud. So I'm about to start that process again. And with the puppies that hopefully get healthy puppies that we hopefully get next week, I'll sell some of them as puppies, only to people that I trust that will look after them and train them properly. So there's already a waiting list of 3 or 4 shepherds want puppies from Floss, fathered by Tan. I'll probably keep 2 or 3 of them, and I'll train them for 6 or 8 months using that technique, and I'll pick the absolute best one to join my team, and I'll sell the 2 next best ones to other people. And it's absolutely amazing. It's like a lot of things, isn't it? When somebody teaches you how to do it properly, it's a whole other world of interest and skill and other things opens up in front of you. So I'm now really, really into that. I don't do the competitive sheepdog trialing where you go and compete against other people. I just have work dogs. I think the truth being that I'm not quite brave enough to go and put myself on public display, but as work dogs, they're very good. Okay, is there any question from the gentleman there?
Can you repeat the name of the video?
Okay. So I think the title of the DVD is How to Train Your Sheepdog. And the author is a guy called Andy Nicholas, which is Andy, N-I-C-K-L-E-S-S. And if you look on Twitter, he's called @sheepdogtrainer. And almost every week he puts on these little demo clips. And he's really good because he shows you different kinds of dogs with different personalities. He's like, okay, if you've got this crazy dog that won't stop barking, this is how you deal with it. If you've got this dog that chases cars, this is how you deal with it. It's good. There are other people as well. I've no particular reason to just plug Andy, but he's very good. Ah, okay, so there might be an issue about compatibility with UK DVDs, but, yeah. Okay, so you might just want to be careful to get the right kind of DVD. Yeah, okay. Okay, any other questions about sheepdogs? Do we use a whistle? A whistle commands are better than voice commands on a windy mountain. If you want the command to carry 1.5 miles or something across a mountain, you have much more chance with a whistle than voice commands. They're also much harder. The truth is I mostly use voice commands. But then the vast majority of my work is within a sort of 3/4 of a mile radius from where I'm standing. Some of my friends are professional fell shepherds or mountain shepherds.
and they spend like 100 plus days a year gathering fells. And they might have a team of 10 dogs, and maybe five of them go today and five of them go tomorrow, and they sort of alternate them to rest them. But to work those dogs at a distance is usually done by a whistle. And some of the stuff these dogs, like my dogs are pretty good. They're field dogs and eye dogs. You know what a field dog and an eye dog is? Okay, so my dogs are bred to be brilliant when they can see the sheep. Okay, they have that border collie thing where they're like, it's like sort of, you know, when the Death Star fixes onto a planet in Star Wars. And okay, that's what my sheepdogs have got. The sheep moves, the dog moves to the side, and it has its eye on them the whole time. Brilliant in normal farmland. But actually, to do the best work on the mountains, you need a different dog, which does what you tell it when you ask it to go back and back and back. It's traveling back through rocks, it's traveling through bracken, it's going further. There's no sheep in sight. My dogs are starting to freak out at about 3/4 of a mile. They're like, why are you asking me to go back? What is this? There's no sheep, I can't see any sheep. And they're uncomfortable with that. But a true fell dog, like my friend Joe Weir has, it'll go, if you can keep the command going, it'll go a mile. It'll go a mile and a half. It might even go 2 miles across the other side of the valley, and it'll still go back. And it's not about eye. It's about sort of a different kind of intelligence. And they can hunt out of the bracken or the trees sheep using their own intelligence, and they'll bring them back through like a gully or a ravine without commands, knowing full well that they're in command, and they'll bring them back. Don't tell him. If you see this actually in practice, it's most extreme. This is amazing. Like some guy on the other side of the valley is fetching 5 sheep back off a mountain crag just using a whistle. It's like, gee whiz. Don't tell him that. He's one of my best friends. Don't tell him I admire that. So like the sheep come back after doing the most amazing thing we've seen ever, and they'll be like, me and my mate stood there going, yeah, all right. It's nothing really. okay. Okay, so what do we eat? Well, I'm a vegetarian. You don't believe that. I'm not. I had to laugh. Forgive, for those of you that don't like bad language, just cover your ears for a moment. I had to laugh. I was watching a cooking program one night where Gordon Ramsay was asked in the kitchen what the vegetarian option was, and he said, vegetarian option? It's bugger off. which perhaps reflects the darker person inside me. But no, the truth is I really, really firmly believe in eating as locally produced food as you can when you can. I think that's really, really important. You cut down the food miles and the carbon and all the rest of it. And I trust the food from my own landscape. You know, you start fetching stuff in packets from somewhere else. I don't really know who produced it. I don't really know whether I agree with how they did it. So we try to eat as much of our own lamb as possible. And we can obviously only produce so many things in that landscape, so I can't produce pak choi and Chinese vegetables and things to have a Chinese meal, but we try and eat as much of our own produce as possible, and we try and do that in as hands-on way as possible. I think if you're going to eat, you've got to face up to what it really means, haven't you? So the killing of the animal, the skinning of the animal, try and become involved in all of that, and therefore try and respect what we're eating as much as we possibly can. So we eat quite a bit of meat. The truth is, until I was 20, we lived on potatoes and stew and mince. Yeah, like proper European peasants. And in the last 25, 30 years, that's changed into eating a bit more like everybody else. So we'll have noodles, we'll have fajitas or whatever it is. So we eat a whole bunch of different things now. But I know I've got to finish in a moment. One of the best things I've done recently is I've got a friend called Ivan Day, who's a food historian. He lives near to where I live. Amazing guy. He's like the go-to guy for every TV producer in the world when they make a program about Edwardian food or how they ate in Norman castles. He's like done the research, he's got the tools, he's got the knives and all the rest of it. So he invited us to dinner about 5 months ago, 4 months ago now, and I provided him with a Herdwick sheep, and his mission was to cook this, how they used to cook it in the old-fashioned farmhouses. And I didn't really know what that meant, but we pictured up at his house. He has the old-fashioned farmhouse stove, right? The coal banked up in the front of it. He has all of the old machinery, which you wind up, and then the weight comes down, and the meats, the leg of lamb that I gave him is turning in front of the fire. And the historic breeds have more fat than the lowland breeds. It's better fat, but the fat is there for a reason. If you're buying the leanest meat you can in the supermarket, you're a muppet, because the food is, the fat in meat is there for a reason to give it the flavor. Yeah. So when you saw it cooked the traditional way, you could see why. Because this thing's turning around all the time, and that good fat is basting it and making the most delicious juicy meat you've ever tasted in your life. And beneath it was a potato cake, and the dripping from the meat was dripping to form a crust on top of the potato cake. Next up, he makes something which I've never seen before in my life, which is and I forget which way around it was, but he made haver cakes and clap cakes. Now, a haver cake is like, what do you call the Mexican, yeah, that you sort of break, the cardboardy ones that you break? Is that tortilla? It's what? Yeah, like the taco. So he makes like this, our version of the taco, which is a sort of oatmeal, sort of crusty biscuit thing. And you break a bit of this, you put some of the lamb on the top, you put a little bit of chutney or reserve on the top, and you taste it amazing. But even better were the other things he made, which I think were the clap cakes. And they're like a pancake, like a chapati. Yeah? And the same thing again, the old way was that you put them in your hand, you put some of the lamb, it was like Indian food. And I've never even seen this. So I'm this guy that wrote a book about how great our farming system is and how marvelous the lamb is that we had. I've never even seen it cooked properly till I'm at this house. And I kid you not, I have never tasted better meat in my life than what he did with that leg of lamb of ours. And it's got me thinking, because I'm thinking, hang on a minute, we're not selling this right. We're not cooking it right. We're not telling people how to do this. So I'm on a bit of a mission at the moment to work out where we go with this. Maybe one of my kids can be the person that puts that back on the map. I don't know. The other thing that he's doing, I gave him four legs. The other three, he's curing in the old-fashioned way. So in our landscape, they have these big farmhouse chimneys, okay? And in October at the start of winter, when you had this glut of the lambs coming off the mountain, actually it wasn't the lambs, it was the 3- and 4-year-old males. They used to keep them till 3 or 4 years old, because the best lamb in the world, the best mutton is older. They would kill 4, 5, 6, 8 of these things and then smoke dry them or air dry them in the chimney. And it was like a kind of Parma ham. They would put sort of rub various things in every day. And then all winter long, you would carve off these little slivers of mutton that was like Parma ham. And they still do it in, I forget what they call it, they still do it in Norway. They have it with berries, they have it with bread. Amazing way to eat mutton and lamb. And this guy's doing that for me at the moment, and he's going to fetch these other three legs back to our place, and I'm going to spend the rest of winter experimenting in how good this is. The only thing I didn't tell you about this meat was, historically, the meat off these Herdwick sheep was considered to be the best mutton in the world. So when the Queen had a coronation in the, what was that, late 1940s, around there sometime, the best meat that they could serve anybody was Herdwick mutton. So that's what they did. They served Herdwick mutton at the coronation. And sadly, over the following decades, it ended up where the only people eating mutton were quite often the British Asian community. So the older ewes that we sell, when they get really old and they go into the food chain, it's probably some of the best meat in Britain, and it's only eaten by people in the British Asian community who know how to cook mature meat properly and put the spices in and do all the exciting things with it. So if you ever have a curry in England, you've probably eaten Herdwick meat from the mountains. I've got to shut up now. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
That was James Rebanks talking about what it's like to be a shepherd in his little part of England. Oh, so that meat sounded pretty good, didn't it, Donna?
Yeah, I'm hungry.
Wow, that's good. I have a little bit of information here. James Rebanks is, he's a shepherd. It's very romantic, but he's part of the modern world, too. He tweets and he writes and he travels on airplanes. And this little story here, he came to Iowa this last week. He flew into the Chicago airport from London, and of course he had to meet with a fine customs officer, and he was met with the question of, "What do you do for a living, sir?" And he told the man he was a writer, and for some reason that caused a bit of a kerfluffle. He was hauled away and talked to quite strongly for about half an hour, so he missed his flight to Iowa. He was a little late for the conference, but that was fine.
So writers are getting stopped at customs.
It must be. There must be something about writers. However, besides me telling you this, James Rebanks has a very active Twitter life at HurdyShepherd1. He Twittered this information, and as of now, 1.5 million people have read that Twitter, and along with a lot of other journalists, word travels. If you want to find more about him, look for the book, The Shepherd's Life by James Rebanks, or at HurdyShepherd1 Twitter feed. Yes, there we go. It was a nice conference. I enjoyed meeting him.
Yeah, he was really lovely. Good pick to come and help Iowans appreciate their ancestral farming heritage.
Yes, And farming, food, it's a great combination. We have some upcoming things happening. I have a little note here that Mustard Seed Farm, a fine farm here just north of Ames, is sponsoring a swap, a good time of year for a swap. Go into that closet, go into that pantry, go into that basement and find stuff. Bring it and share it. Get rid of what you need. Get rid of what you don't need. All free. Yep. This is get rid of things. Things go to a good home. The swap will be at Wesley Hall, East Entrance, and the Collegiate Methodist Church in Ames, 2622 Lincoln Way, near the bank drive-in. Swap will be from 6:30 to 8:30 this Saturday, January 27th. And that is right before. You can just go to the next building over and go to the Central Iowa Barn Dance. It's that same evening. Go to Central Iowa Barn Dance, CIBD.org, to find out more about that.
All right. And our show next week will sort of stay in the same neighborhood as the Lake District, only, I mean, here in Iowa.
Yeah.
But Lana and Joe went to a Robert Burns night sponsored by the Mucky Duck with all things Scottish. So we'll hear about that next week.
Right. Very good. You've been listening to The Donalana Kitchen. You can listen Tuesdays at noon, repeated Tuesday at 7 p.m. or anytime at khoifm.org. Thanks for joining us today. Support this fine radio station. We had music by Liz Donaldson, Becky Ross, and Colleen Reed. Some English country dance music. We are going out with a little tune called The Collier's Daughter. I'm Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had fine engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.